طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. One of the great horrors of the Israeli occupation of Palestine is the brutal treatment of children by the Israeli military. This morning we get a vivid look at the abuse of Palestinian children by the Israeli military through the eyes of Ivan Karakashian, who represents Defense for Children International Palestine, an organization which defends children caught up in the Israeli military courts. These are Palestinian children. Israeli children, when arrested, are processed in the Israeli civil court process, never in military courts. Just the opposite is true of Palestinian children. They are only processed in the military courts, and you are about to hear the difference. Here is Ivan Karakashian of Defense for Children International Palestine, speaking to a group from Boston visiting Israel-Palestine through the Grelta Foundation.
So just to start, Defense for Children International Palestine is we have the word international in our name, but we're very much a local Palestinian NGO. We belong to the worldwide movement, Defense for Children International, but each section is autonomous in terms of its funding and programming, and we don't really report to the central office. In that way, we're really more of a franchise than a branch office. And then the majority, we were set up in 1991 by Rafat Qassis, who himself was in prison for about 6 months, and during his prison term, he realized that children in the military courts and the military detention system were being kept with adults, and realized that children weren't receiving any kind of special protections and their special needs weren't being met. So immediately upon his release, he established Defense for Children International Palestine in 1991 as a strictly legal aid organization for children in distress, and specifically children encountering the military court system. And then in the year 2000, we expanded and we started documenting all violations committed by the Israeli side against Palestinians living in the occupied Palestinian territory. And then in the year 2005, we expanded yet again and began representing children in Palestinian courts accused of Palestinian crimes, as well as documenting violations against children by the Palestinian Authority and by the Palestinian groups. And it's at that point that we became a fully fledged children's rights organization. We're currently the only considered local Palestinian children's organization operating. Some of our key funders and donors and people we work with regularly would be Save the Children, UNICEF, the United Nations Development Program. We're also funded by a few European governments like Sweden, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and several church groups and faith-based communities both in the U.S. and in Europe. So that's DCI. Then really what my talk will focus on is the Israeli military detention system and what it's doing, because you're about to go encounter that, all of you, with the exception of Steve. Apologies again. But then it'll move on to some of the recent violence that we've witnessed against Palestinian children. And then if you guys have questions also about some of the violations on the Palestinian side, I'd be more than happy to answer some of those. And I'll explain the difference in our advocacy at some point between working with the Palestinian side versus the Israeli side. But the first thing that I hope you've heard by now is that in the West Bank there are two legal systems operating. One applies to all Palestinians since 1967 in its military law, and that applies to everyone, adults, children alike. And the other is Israeli civilian law, which applies to the all settlers living in the West Bank. That, to me, didn't come into complete clear view until I realized what it meant in practice. And in practice, what it means is the Israeli army is here to impose military law, whereas and is not there to administer civilian law. So if you had a group of young Jewish settlers clashing with a group of young Palestinians, the Israeli army has the authority to arrest the young Palestinians, but has no authority to arrest the young Jewish settlers because they belong under civilian law, and only the Israeli police should be arresting the Jewish settlers. So essentially what you end up... And then, moreover, some of the crimes that exist under, or offenses that exist under military law don't exist under the civilian legal system. And so a Palestinian could be committing crime while a Jewish settler could be doing the exact same act and not be committing that crime. And so one person would get arrested, the other wouldn't. And those are just, you know, this real discrimination that exists in that system and how it applies to Palestinians. Israel is the only country in the world that systematically prosecutes and convicts somewhere between 500 to 700 children every year in military courts. That's the case that we've been documenting that since at least 2000, that number specifically. And then within the within that number, we find that children during arrest in the first 24 to 48 hours experience all kinds of abuse and violations of their rights. And that's when the arrest process begins. So the majority of children are arrested between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. The reason Israeli soldiers arrest, or the reason they say they arrest children between midnight and 5 a.m. is because if they arrested them in the middle of the day, they'll say it'll cause more clashes and be more dangerous to all sides, so it's easier to come in the middle of the night and arrest these children. That is kind of like a false choice, because the other thing that they could do is they could summon children to appear for questioning. That's something that Defense for Children International Palestine raised and UNICEF through UNICEF to the Israeli authorities, and they began piloting a summons system to ask children to come in for questioning. But they haven't kept up any data about how the summons process was going, and they haven't told anyone where they're applying this pilot program and whether they're still applying it or not. It's unclear to them.
So they're not arresting children who are out on the streets in these hours, they're going to their homes.
What happens is a lot of the times, if there's a sort of a protest or a clash mm-hmm. taking place, from the military watchtowers, you'll have like soldiers taking photographs of all the people in the area, and then they'll go in later that night to see, you know, they'll have sort of an idea of what the children, their ages, and who lives in each area, and they'll have their ID numbers, and they'll go into the house seeking the same ID number and then comparing it to the photo they took earlier in the day. Oftentimes, but they're taking photos not necessarily of children throwing stones or in the act of an offense, but really just any and everyone in the area. So it'd be a lot of children on rooftops watching what's going down on the street, and those guys will get snapped up first. In fact, the rate of free arrest is extremely high because it's the same children that live next to the same military watchtower that are repeatedly getting their photos taken, repeatedly getting picked up for questioning. So what these children, but with the summons process, just so I could wrap up with that, essentially what Israel did for a while was they would send units of soldiers to their home. they would raid the home in the middle of the night, carry out all the exact same violations, but before leaving at 3 or 4 a.m., leave a piece of paper in Hebrew saying, you know, we're summoning you for questioning the next day at 8 a.m., and then leave. And then once the dad brought the child at 8 a.m. for questioning, he would be immediately separated from his child, and the child would then go through the exact same abuses he was going through afterwards. So while we believe the summons process would help stop a lot of these violations, the way it's being applied is not in good faith by the Israeli authorities. But to just quickly describe the experience of a child being arrested in the middle of the night, usually what happens is you have a unit or two of soldiers raiding the home. You know, we hear sometimes between 14 to 18 soldiers come to the home. They'll raid the home. They'll go in. They'll start destroying furniture as they search the entire house. We've had some children wake up in their bedroom in their pajamas, only to find about 5 soldiers surrounding them, aiming their machine guns and telling them to get up very quickly with them. Of course, when that happens, something very quickly happens to the child psychologically, which is the child realizes that his home isn't a safe place, that his room doesn't offer any kind of privacy or safety. And more importantly, he realizes that his parents are powerless to protect him. When soldiers show up to arrest children, they don't have to show you, they don't have to tell or inform the parents where the child is being taken or why the child has been arrested. They just say, we need to take this child, he's done something wrong, and they take him. So essentially, for a certain period of time, depending on the age of the child disappears in a sense, where the parents don't know exactly where that child's being taken or why he has been taken. If the child is 12 or 13 years old, it's usually about 24 hours. If he's 14 and 15, it's 48 hours that he disappears. And if he's 16 or 17, it's up to 96 hours that they don't really know where he is. Yeah.
How often is this going on with how many kids?
So it's estimated around this year that it'd be around 1,000 kids, 1,200
so
kids.
Three times a day.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And is that happening?
But there's a big difference between children they detain and children they arrest. Okay. They detain far more children than they arrest children. So during clashes, like you were asking, you know, are these the children? They might detain a lot of children during clashes, but they'll let them go within 2 to 3 hours or maybe up to 6 hours. But essentially, they won't charge them with anything. With arrested children, it's the ones that end up being convicted in military courts, and that's where the 500 to 700 a number estimate comes in.
And this is happening in the West Bank?
This is specifically in
the
West Bank.
It's not Israel proper?
It's not. The military...
Doesn't operate there.
Doesn't operate, and the military law doesn't apply to Israel civilians. And also, even though it applies in the West Bank, it doesn't apply to Jewish settlers living in the West Bank. So it only applies to Palestinians in the West Bank. Yeah, it also doesn't apply to Palestinians living in East Jerusalem because Israel considers the entirety of Jerusalem its undivided capital and therefore applies civilian law to everyone, including East Jerusalemites who tend to be all Palestinians. But within the civilian legal system and civilian criminal law, there's a lot of discrimination. So even though Palestinians living in East Jerusalem have that these protections in theory, when they show up before a judge, they'll face a lot of discrimination the way the judge administers the law to them in East Jerusalem. And so what happens with these children is then they're immediately blindfolded. The Israeli army puts plastic hand ties on their wrists, often so tightly that when our lawyers catch up with these children a few days later, they'll still find the markings of the plastic cord. And then the children are placed on the metal floor of the military jeep. And that's usually when the physical violence begins. Between the years 2012 and 2015, we collected 429 affidavits in equal numbers from children, and about 75% of all those children suffered some form of physical violence at the hand of the arresting officers and throughout the interrogation that first 24-hour period. What's important is once they've been arrested, they no longer pose a threat. And so to suffer violence after you no longer pose a threat is a particular violation of their rights. So we've had children being slapped, kicked, punched. The soldiers will use the butts of their rifles against these children. In some extreme circumstances, we've had soldiers extinguish cigarette butts on the lips and the arms of the children. We've had one case where a soldier had an empty beer bottle that he smashed on the head of one of the children. So abuses vary while you're en route being transferred to a military base. And because these children are being arrested in the middle of the night, the interrogator is typically not ready to interrogate these children because he's sleeping. And so the children will get moved around from military base to military base until it's time for their interrogation period. Throughout that time, children are sort of kept blindfolded, except every time they go from one military base to the next. They are strip searched. They meet a doctor, asks them some very common questions, and doesn't even care what they answer. But they strip search the children every time they go through to a military base, and then they'll let them get dressed again, put back the blindfolds, put back the hand ties. They won't bring the children any food or water or access to toilets. And if the child asks for any of those three things, you could expect more abuse. And in the military bases, we've also recorded several instances where they'll let children into a small room with the military dogs. And they know Palestinian children are specifically scared of these dogs. And just anything to sort of frighten the child. By the time the child shows up to interrogation, he's gone through something like 12 hours where the trauma started at home. He was beaten up on the way to the military bases. His parents have no idea where he was taken or why he was taken. He's feeling completely alone. It's been 12 hours of this abuse, and then he's brought into an interrogation room with a very professional interrogator wanting to get a confession out of that child. If the child doesn't immediately confess, and then children in the military, under military law, have really two rights only: the right to remain silent, and the right to consult an attorney prior to the interrogation. They're under military law not allowed to have the attorney present during the interrogation or to have a parent present during the interrogation.
They can consult an attorney before interrogation, but not during.
But they can't have the attorney sitting with them during the interrogation. Yeah. And then in fact, in 97% of cases, they're denied consulting with an attorney prior to interrogation. So even though they have that right, it's denied to them in about 97% of cases that we documented from those 429 affidavits. Moreover, the children, even though they're sort of, we used to say that children aren't informed of their rights at all. So now there's a piece of paper that they present the children with Arabic and Hebrew stating those two rights, and they force the children to sign this piece of paper. But often the children don't have the time to read, and even if they read, the interrogators don't ask the children whether they've properly understood their rights, and they're just asked to sign it. The paper's taken away. That way, when we come and say they're not informed of their rights, they can present that piece of paper and say, look, he signed it, you must know his rights. So now we say that children aren't properly informed of their rights to a level where they understand them and can apply them. And then during the interrogation, if the child doesn't cooperate with the interrogator, then you'll expect, you know, the old phone book, or the interrogator will bring in a baton and hit the child with it. And you'll get all kinds of physical violence, shaking, slapping on the ears to disorient the child. Throughout the interrogation, the child is handcuffed and shackled to a small metal chair in an uncomfortable position. So there's quite a lot of position abuse and rising the use of position abuse while interrogating these children. And then if the child still doesn't cooperate after that level of physical violence is applied, then they'll start using psychological violence, and specifically the use of solitary confinement against children. Here, solitary confinement is used in a way that's very different than the way it's used in the U.S. In the U.S., if solitary confinement is being used against a child, it's usually after the child has been convicted of a crime. And it's if he steps out of line while serving his sentence, they might use solitary confinement as a punishment. Or oftentimes you'll hear the argument in the U.S. that it's to protect the child, and so they want to separate him from a particularly hostile group of people, or they don't have the facilities to separate him from adults, so they'll place him into solitary confinement. In the Israeli context, a child is placed into solitary confinement before he's been even charged with a crime. And they'll put a child into solitary confinement until the child is ready to confess to wrongdoing so that they could then charge the child with that wrongdoing. We've had this year a rise in the number of solitary confinement cases. There are about 17% of children are put through solitary confinement. This was for this year's statistics. That translates to, out of the 158 cases we document, well over, I think, 25 or 26 were placed into solitary confinement this year from the cases that we documented. The longest period that a child spent in solitary confinement this year was 29 days. So 29 days in a cell that's about the size of one and a half of these tables. So it's a very small cell.
Yeah.
From here to here, yeah. And it has no windows. There's a small open slit at the top of one of the walls that lets in cold air. And in the summer, it doesn't let in enough cold air, and in the winter, it lets in too much cold air. Yeah.
A child that would be kept in solitary for that length of time, would that be someone, you know, 16, 17?
The majority are 16 and 17. We've had a few 15-year-olds also kept
in solitary. But not the older kids who were pulled in?
No, it'd be seldom that a 14 or 13-year-old would be put
in. So 15 and over, probably.
15 and over, yeah. I would say the vast majority, yeah. And then there's a yellow dim light that's kept on 24 hours so that the child doesn't know what time of day it is. There's a small, thin mattress for the child to stay on. And because there are protrusions coming out of the wall, it makes it difficult for the child to lean up against any of the walls. So he has to stay in the center of the room. And the only human contact he has is when he's brought out intermittently for interrogation or when the flap in the door is open and his fruit tray is brought in. We even had one 17-year-old last year spent about 45 days in that condition. And according to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, if an adult spends any time longer than 2 days, it's tantamount to torture. So if you can imagine someone under the age of 18 spending 45 days, 29 days, and at that point the child hasn't done anything wrong. They haven't charged the child, you know, he's presumed innocent and yet thrown into solitary confinement.
When they're in solitary, they're no longer blindfolded or wristbound, right?
No, they're no longer blindfolded or wristbound.
Why would they hold somebody in solitary for so long if there's no charges? Wouldn't that be a waste of resources, or is there some other...
It's to force the child to confess.
To something, even if they haven't been charged for X number of days, like 5, 6, 7, 8,
yeah, they have the ability to not charge the child for up to, I think, 55 days.
Okay.
And so they could keep you there under suspicion, but you have to appear before a military court judge to get sort of reviewed. And so sometimes if they've put you in solitary confinement, the interrogator will appear before a military court judge, explain the extenuating circumstances, and ask for more time in interrogating the child.
It sounds like a false confession. Why would they want a false confession?
It is a false confession. That's the point that I'm getting to. A lot of these confessions are what we would consider coerced confessions that should be immediately thrown out from the courts. Even the cases that don't involve solitary confinement but involve physical violence during the interrogations or other types of duress should immediately be thrown out. Unfortunately...
But why would they want that, though?
Why would they
want... Why would I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Why would they want forced confession? Because the military judges accept it. They never question these. They don't throw out these forced confessions.
Why would they want a conviction based on a forced confession?
It's a good question. Yeah. So just to let you know, the military court system has a 99% conviction rate.
Yeah.
And so they convict everyone. Why are they convicting these children specifically? And why are they arresting through convicting these children, putting them through the military court system? We believe it's, you know, when you hear courts, you think courts administer justice, but we believe that in this case, the military courts administer control over a population.
So that's the ultimate
goal. And that's the ultimate goal. If you have children, which is the most vulnerable demographic of Palestinian society, and you put them through these horrific conditions of the military court system, then you ensure that the rest of the population stays in control.
So they want control over them, and this is a...
They want to put fear...
Because ultimately they want to push...
That's them. How they sustain the overall occupation, you know, there's... It's also similar to some of the... You guys went to Hebron already?
Yes.
Yeah, so in Hebron, we speak... I went on a few speaking tours with Breaking the Silence, which is a group of former Israeli soldiers that have decided to talk about what their experiences have gone through. And one thing that one of those soldiers mentioned while I was speaking to him was that there are small units of soldiers controlling a population in the hundreds of thousands in Hebron. So how do you get, you know, 20, 30, 40 soldiers managing to control a population of several hundred thousand?
And that control is all ultimately about possession of the land.
Possession of the land, but how do you get Palestinians wholesale not to protest and go out in the streets and then kill all 40 soldiers, because 100,000 people could effectively manage to overtake 40 soldiers?
That's what they said in Nabi Salah, that they stopped the demonstrations because all of the kids between 10 and 15 or whatever had all been arrested. Basically.
Yeah. But even if you arrest them and release them, what you're doing is that entire system of control that you're putting over that population enables a handful of soldiers to control a large population. It's through intimidation, through, you know, occasionally beating up a random Palestinian for no reason, and through the arrest process, which they use. They use any kind of tactic to show and establish the strength of their presence in an area. And the military court system is part and parcel of that attitude of establishing strength, possession, and occupation over an area.
I just want to ask, Ivan, the solitary confinement, the physical abuse, I'm assuming that that's also intended not only to gain a confession, but also to gain information, intelligence information from the child as to who else in the village is causing problems, or... Am I mistaken on that?
Most children do confess against other children as well. So what you end up with, what our lawyers end up with when they receive a file for a client, is the confession of that child, the confession of the other children that were with that child, but all of which
the
were all...
You have a confession of the accusation, the finger...
Yeah, like let's say five children went out throwing stones. They'll get each of the four to say that the fifth one also threw a stone, and they'll go around. But actually, what we found that there are a few cases where they try to put a lot of pressure on the child to become an ongoing informant. And those cases are more anecdotal. Obviously, it's difficult to get a child to say, yes, I'm now an informant for the Israeli authorities on the record. We know that it does take place, that a lot of that pressure is applied to try and turn some of these children into informants. But the majority of the cases are not that. The majority of the cases are getting children to confess against other children in a very particular incident, but not to become ongoing informants. And then the third thing that our lawyers get is the statement of the arresting military officer. And because it's a military system, they never question the statement of the military officer. So if the military officer will just say, I'm arresting you because I think I saw you throwing stones, that's perfect. You know? And if the child then says, yes, I threw stones, and they get two other children that say, that child threw stones, that's the entirety of the case.
Innocent until suspected.
And then what happens is our lawyers receive this file with these three or four documents, And then they realize you can't really practice law with that amount. You know, they're not allowed to really present evidence or call for evidence. And so what ends up happening is the majority of the cases end up in plea deals between the lawyer and the Israeli military prosecutor. And so it's important for our lawyers, for DCI's lawyers, to maintain good relationships with the military prosecutors in order to get the best deals for these children. And then part of why we say it's a system of control is if a child decides I'm innocent and I don't want to plead guilty for a plea deal, the majority of children are denied bail. About 87% of children are denied bail during their court proceedings. And court proceedings for an offense can take up to a year or longer. And if you're denied bail, you're in prison for that year or longer period. And with a 99% conviction rate, you'd end up essentially spending a year or longer in prison only to get a guilty verdict in the end anyway. Whereas if children do plea deals, we found that most children receive a plea deal between 3 to 12 months, which is actually shorter. It's shorter and a faster way out of the military system if you plead guilty, whether you've done something or not, than if you plead innocent and then get denied bail and spend all that time in jail waiting for a court verdict.
So the average length of stay is between 3 and 12 months.
For children who plea.
How much does it cost to incarcerate somebody, you know, a child, for that period of time? Because there's going to be a cost associated with it to Israel. And how many children are locked up for that period?
The majority, so about like 53% of children that we documented between out of the 429 affidavits are the ones that spend between 3 to 12 months. You have the remaining percentages are children who spend under 3 months or children who end up spending well over 12 months. The prison system and how you pay for that stuff is actually very, very interesting. It's actually a bit of an industry where the Israeli system ends up making money out of these children. Out of the canteens that the Israeli system operates within the prison, so let's say you wanted an extra bed sheet, or you wanted toothpaste, or you wanted a toothbrush, or an additional pajama, you'd have to purchase that from the canteen. And I think it's estimated that the canteen makes the Israeli system about 18 million shekels a month.
But how much does it cost to actually incarcerate these kids per month? Because I used to work in jail and prison. That was And there's no way we could have ever, even with our mass prison, you know, over like our mass incarceration in the U.S., we could never pay for the costs of incarceration and make money on it through the canteen purchases. And that's not even just because people are poor, it's just the costs of the salaries, the infrastructure, the food.
That's the thing. There's very little infrastructure, very little provided for these, for children specifically here. Yeah. Very little is provided by the Israeli prison service in terms of provisions for these children. So, and I'll compare here with Israeli prisons.
Well, most of this cost would be the salaries anyway.
But there are no salaries. That's the thing. So what they've done is... Wait one sec. Yeah. So what they've done is the Palestinian National Prisoners Committee agreed with the Israeli prison services that several of their adult members would take care of these children and look after these children so that these children don't have direct contact with the Israeli prison guards and therefore wouldn't face abuse by the Israeli prison guards. It's effectively what the National Prisoners Committee ended up doing is they found five Palestinian adult prisoners serving long-term sentences and made them surrogate parents for these children. They live in the same juvenile section as the children, but they're kept in a separate cell.
Did you say these are other people who are criminally convicted?
Who are convicted of so-called security offenses. Okay, so we differentiate between security and criminal.
Okay.
So they're not murderers and rapists, they've done security offenses against Israel.
Which could be something as a false charge or a false confession.
Potentially, but except, you know, some of these are serving the law. You know, they don't want to keep on switching out these five prisoners. Mm-hmm. So the ones that they've selected are ones serving 10 or more years of sentence. So typically their charges tend to be
something real
or higher. Yeah. But basically they're nominated by the National Palestinian Prisoners Committee.
So these guys are overlooking all the
overseeing the kids. About 70 to 75 kids in Meshuggah
prison. So it's 1 to 75 ratio.
No, it's 5 to 75.
5 to 75, okay. 5 to 75. So who's overlooking those 5 people?
So then you have a few prison guards, okay. Israeli prison guards, that oversee. So, and then what happens is if the child needs something, he'll tell the surrogate parent, which is that Palestinian prisoner, and then the Palestinian prisoner will tell the head of the National Palestinian Committee based in that prison, who will then have official talks with the warden of that prison.
Yvonne, what is the name, please, again, of the prison?
Meshuggah, M-E-G-I-D-D-O.
M-E-G-I-D-D-O prison, okay.
So if there were a serious situation with a child, there's not immediate treatment because it's got to go through all of these levels before anyone even...
No, but like if the child was severely sick, for example, then an adult Palestinian prison, one of the adult Palestinians will tell the medical staff immediately and will accompany that child.
Okay, so it doesn't have to go through all those...
No, this is more like the children want, like they have a big demand and it's important. And then,
okay.
And so the way the National Palestinian Prisoners Committee won the right to get these 5 adults to take care of these children is they went on hunger strike and it was through long negotiations. And so since 2009, these 5 individuals have been taking care of these children. And then the prison authorities don't provide the food for the children. In fact, a lot of the food, but I need to double check this, a lot of the food is actually sent in by the Palestinian Authority, and it's sent in uncooked form, so it's, you know, raw chickens and whatever, and it's kept in a freezer, and then the children end up cooking their own meals under the supervision of the 5 adult prisoners. So the 5 adult prisoners are actually... take care of the children generally, but each has a role, and one of them takes on the role of overseeing, teaching these children how to cook their own meals.
What about health care? Because kids, I mean...
They receive health care, but they're not denied health care. They receive decent health care if something is wrong with them.
Who pays for it? Who pays for it?
Again, no, that would be the Israel Prison Service.
Israel Prison Service does, okay.
So Meshuggah would be within Israel. That's an Israel.
Meshuggah would be within
and
Israel.
That's the Hebrew name for Armageddon, as I recall. You don't know. I think it is. And the fact that these children are taken out of the occupied territories... And
that's in
violation
of the 4th Geneva Convention. That actually has practical consequences as well, because it means that when their parents go to visit, they need to get a permit, and they need to coordinate with the Red Cross. But a lot of parents struggle to get a permit, and it takes them about 2 months or longer to get a permit. And sometimes by the time they get that permit, their child is ready to be released anyway. And so they won't visit that child throughout this period of incarceration because of difficulty to get access. Also, like, you know, things that exist in an Israeli prison for Israeli children that doesn't exist for Palestinian children. Israeli children have access to counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, a lot of educators, and a lot of just general care around them. Also, Israeli children, for example, are taken out on field visits. They get to, sometimes they're released during the holiday periods back to their parents. None of this stuff exists for Palestinian children. Also, Israeli children are taught in keeping with the Israeli curriculum so that upon their release, they could immediately reintegrate back into the school system. A child once took the matriculation exam at an Israeli prison that had a lot of mental health issues. The one thing that kept him calm was having a parrot on his shoulder. So they allowed him to take the exam with a parrot on his shoulder. There's a petting zoo for these. So operating a prison for Israeli children is extremely expensive. Yeah, none of this stuff is provided for Palestinian children. Palestinian children are provided with an education, in quotes, but really the only approved subjects are math, Arabic, and Hebrew. And they're taught at an elementary level, and the way the children are divided is based on their level of assessed intelligence. And so what you end up having is you have an extremely intelligent 17-year-old with an extremely intelligent 13-year-old taking the same math class.
When you put those types of kids together, like at that type different age range, you're going to have, in the United States anyway, the potential for a lot of bullying, and that creates a whole other series of traumas. Does that go on here, or is there a little bit more empathy among the kids because they're all in a sort of shared experience?
There's a little bit of empathy among the kids, but also there's quite a lot of respect of the five adult prisoners, and they keep everyone in line. And if someone steps out of line, which does actually happen occasionally, no, they'll, for example, deny him TV privileges.
Right, exactly.
They'll find a way to punch the ground him. Yes, grab that child. Yeah, but in general, we hear of very little actual bullying taking place.
With there being probably little bullying, you probably also don't hear about like sexual assaults on kids or anything.
In
the U.S., in this sort of situation, if the system was set up like this in the U.S., I would guarantee it would happen. You know, I would put my job on it. You know, and I don't mean that in a good way. I mean it would be a really unfortunate consequence.
But no, and again, I think the main difference here is a lot of these is the differentiation between a security offense and a criminal offense.
Yeah,
I think there was a couple of Jerusalem children that were placed that were sort of convicted on a security offense, but placed with other young Israeli offenders. Some of them were like rapists, murderers, and that kid went through quite a lot of abuse.
Yeah, in the U.S., the bullying happens in schools. And you're from the U.S., right? Or you're
no, I'm not.
No,
from
you
the
just
US.
You just did law school in the U.S.
I did journalism school in the U.S.
Oh, journalism school. Okay, so but you know how it is though. Even in a regular school, the kids experience the bullying and harassment. So that's great that they don't deal with that. Under this, I mean, that's just.
I mean, there is some. Not to say there is.
No, of course.
Not
but it's just nice that there's just one less thing that they're subjected to.
That they're subjected to.
I was concerned
and
about
it's,
that.
And that's actually a testament to how well. Because whenever I tell people that there are five adult male prisoners taking care of these children, people tend to freak out and they're like.
But it seems like they've developed a community where they're really supportive.
Yeah, and every child that I've spoken to after having gone through and lived with these five, what they call surrogate parents, they've all had high praise for the five and said they would never survive their prison experience without these five.
That's great.
Females ever
arrested?
Yeah.
Yeah, female girls under 18, but it's at a far less number than Palestinian boys. So, in February, which was the highest number we recorded ever of Palestinian children in prison since the Israeli Prison Service started providing that data, we had about 440 children in Israeli custody that month, of which 15 were girls.
And
so
they're obviously kept
separate.
And do they have the same surrogate parent situations?
I think because there's so few of them that it hasn't been sort of worked out. Because in the past, up until February of this year, the previous year there was one girl, and she was I think 17. And usually with girls, it's a bit of a different situation. Most girls get arrested in the past, not the 15 once this violent situation escalated here. But in the past, a lot of girls get arrested because they're actually wanting to get arrested to escape some sort of social issue, so forced early marriage or sexual abuse at home, and they don't know how to escape it. They'll walk up with a knife or something at a checkpoint to get arrested to be taken out of that
situation. But they're lucky if they're just arrested.
Well, yeah, they're lucky if they're... And actually, with girls, it's rare that you hear girls getting shot or... The attitude towards boys is far more violent than the attitude towards girls. And this is at least before February of last year. February of last year, no, there were a lot more girls involved and arrested, but a lot more within...
And would those girls also be in prison in Israel?
In Israel, yeah, but in a different prison, in Hasharon,
So there are no prisons in the occupied territories? Any prisoners taken?
No, there are prisons in the... So Ofer, where you guys are... Well, where you guys are going is both a military court and a prison.
Okay.
But technically, once a child is convicted of his crime and is given a final sentence, he's moved out of Ofer. Ofer is only meant to be a temporary holding facility. But because it's easier for children to see their families at Ofer and to attend their court sessions at Ofer, often what they'll do is they'll delay their sentencing until they've spent about 3 months in Ofer, and then they know in their plea deal they're about to get 3 months, and so their transfer inside Israel will only be for that final week, and that ensures they could have access to their parents while at Ofer and access to the courts and not have to be transferred between Megiddo and Ofer.
And the Israeli military is
sort of goes along with it.
That.
Yeah, it goes along with it. But now, if a child is going to serve much longer than 3 months, no, they end up getting shipped to Megiddo. Yeah.
The third educational subject for Palestinian
Arabic, Hebrew, math.
Hebrew.
Yeah.
Hebrew is one of them. And that's what
but it's not Hebrew's not offered at all the prisons. So Hebrew is offered at Ofer, I believe, but not at Megiddo.
And
none of it, by the way, is in keeping with the Palestinian curriculum. So it's not like so even though
it's
you're
like
limited, yeah. Once you and actually that's problematic because even though children are serving like 3 months, and you think, oh, 3 months, it's not the end of the world. The child will get through it somehow. It'll be fine. It won't be fine in the sense that when they fall behind, the Palestinian Ministry of Education has a rule that if an imprisoned child misses more than 60 consecutive days of schooling and they can't keep up with their studies, they would have to repeat the school year.
Right. So it's a double whammy.
Yeah, but I mean, it makes sense because how else can you progress that child forward? The problem is a lot of these children, and something I didn't state at the outset, is come from the most vulnerable families, the most impoverished people we would be worried about as street kids, but instead here they are contending with the Israeli occupation first. But that means when they're released, their parents can't afford private tutoring or support them to catch up with their classes.
You're basically taking an at-risk kid and making them worse off.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And also because of that... because of the experience that children go through, the fact that they're completely cut off from their family throughout their period of the majority of them are cut off for significant periods of their incarceration, it means that the child quickly feels he's become an adult and leaves his childhood behind. And when you want to hold back a child that now feels he's become an adult, he's gone through some sort of rite of passage. They don't want that. They're like, what am I going to be doing with these little kids? You know, I'm now an adult. So a lot of them end up dropping out, getting some sort of vocational training and joining the labor force, where they're open to a lot of exploitation. So, you know, what we realize is those 3 months, 4 months changes the entire trajectory of that kid's life.
You have been listening to a presentation by Ivan Karakashian of the Defense for Children International Palestine. And that wraps it up for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Just click on Listen on the homepage. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.